Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is with us now to talk about some interesting things his office is up to, including new ways to fight the abuse of prescription drugs and the synthetic drugs known as bath salts, also how a big health insurance company tried to reduce its benefits without telling the people who bought the coverage, and a few more things. General Schneiderman, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
These so-called bath salts are still new to a lot of people. It sounds more like something for a jacuzzi, bath salts. What are they exactly?
Well, they are one small part of a category of drugs called synthetic or designer drugs. And these are things that have operated under the radar screen and really been a problem for law enforcement. They're sold in head shops and in magazine stores, delis, bodegas around the city and around the state. And some of them are essentially synthetic marijuana. They look like marijuana, but they're not. They're substances sprayed on other herbs to cause a high or hallucinogenic effect when they're smoked. There are pills. There are things that are supposed to be made into tea. There are bath salts, which are smoked. And it's very clear what's going on with these products. So the reason that they were troubling for law enforcement is that traditional drug enforcement operates by identifying a substance, classifying it as illegal, and then the police can go in and test to see if you're selling that substance and arrest you. This stuff, the chemicals kept changing. It was very hard, even though there were initial efforts made both at the state and federal levels, to add some chemicals to the list of illegal substances to get at these things. The producers just kept changing what they were spraying the herbs with and what they were putting in the supposed bath salts. So my office decided to take a different approach to it, and we sent undercover agents into 16 different locations all over New York State and videotaped and recorded conversations to make it clear that the sellers of these products in head shops sold them, and they may have a stamp that says not for human consumption, but they were giving tutorials on how to smoke them or how to use them. We then used the state's labeling laws, our public health laws, and education laws to clear them out, not because they're on a list of prohibited substances, but because they don't meet any of the requirements for warnings you have to give and information you have to provide to sell any sort of a product. If you buy an over-the-counter drug, you see how many pieces of information the laws require you to provide. So we got 12 different restraining orders and 12 different injunctions in courts all around the state, allowing us to go in and clear these things off the shelves. And we think this is a very exciting new approach to solving this problem. We've reached out to the New York State mayors. We reached out to the Association of Counties and had conversations with folks in the DA's associations to share this approach, and we're sharing our papers with our colleagues in local government and law enforcement. If you can't get at them through a schedule of illegal substances, you can get at them through the mislabeling. And that, you don't even have to know what's in it. You can just go clear the stuff off the shelves and get injunctions against them that ultimately could shut the stores down if they don't comply. So that's all happened in the last week or so. We don't know of anyone else who's taken this approach anywhere else in the country, but we've gotten a terrific response from other colleagues in local government. The District Attorneys Association, which is now chaired by Cy Vance, the Manhattan DA, met over the last weekend, and this is a subject that was much under discussion. These are huge problems they're geared to very young people. The packaging is cartoon-like, clown-like, and it's something that has been spreading under the radar screen. While we've, you know, the war on traditional drugs in some respects has been going better, and we've been reducing traditional drug consumption while the incarceration rate has gone down, by the way, the synthetics and the prescription drugs have really been the fastest-growing problem.
And do I read correctly that your undercover operation on these head shops was on Long Island and upstate? And if so, is it coming next to the city?
Well, we're going to be working in every part of the state. We got to the point where we had concerns about information getting out there. So we moved in 12 spots right away. But yes, we have been in discussions with the Department of Consumer Affairs in New York City and with different counties, different district attorneys. I spoke to both the mayor and Commissioner Mintz before we went in and did the sting about this. So we hope to be working with our colleagues in local governments all across the state.
And I understand you're backing a bill that would track New Yorkers' use of prescription drugs in a new way. Tell us about that.
Well, that actually is a bill I was backing, but it's already been passed by the legislature. It's called iStop. It's an internet system for tracking overprescribing. And it gets at the second problem that has been really sort of a new kind of problem in scope that has been difficult for law enforcement to deal with. The fastest growing drug problem in America is the diversion and misuse of prescription drugs. We know that the use of prescription opioids, Vicodin, oxycodone, things like that, has exploded in recent years. A number of years ago, we passed the point that we had one prescription for these dangerous narcotics for every man, woman, and child in New York State. The irony is that the use of traditional illegal drugs has actually stabilized, in many cases, gone down. We've actually figured out a lot about how to tell who's an addict who needs treatment rather than who's a gangster who just likes to get high. That has been replaced, in many cases, by the diversion of prescription drugs. And this goes into all areas, all neighborhoods, all communities, all ethnic groups, all age groups. The iStop system is the first comprehensive real-time internet system in the country, so that doctors will have to check and see if you go in, if you have 10 other prescriptions. Pharmacists will enter in real time whatever prescriptions they're filling, so we can cut down on doctor shopping, identify the small number of doctors that abuse their powers to overprescribe, and get a handle on this very, very serious problem. There are people who get addicted unintentionally because they think if they get it from a doctor, it's okay. There are gangs that have groups that doctor shop so that they can supply other addicts. In Staten Island, we busted an ice cream truck that was selling tens of thousands of pills for prescription opioids. So this has been a problem in every part of our state, and I'm very proud of the fact that after we identified this as an issue and drafted the initial legislation last summer, there really was a very strong bipartisan coalition that came together around this. It was not held up. It was that no one in Albany tried to tie it to another issue. Senate Republicans, Assembly Democrats, the governor's office, everyone came together. And considering how dramatic a break with the past it was in terms of our way of doing business, it was a very, very fast track for Albany. So over the course of the next year or so, our prescription system will be set up, and New York will be the first state in the country where pharmacists and doctors will have real information about what drugs their patients are on and the ability to counsel people, the ability to report it to law enforcement, and we think it's going to be a big step.
New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, my guest on WNYC. On both of these things, you know, more people all the time are asking, why treat drug abuse as a crime at all rather than a public health problem? That maybe you just perpetrate the violence and the lack of manufacturing standards for the stuff that aren't, you know, manufactured prescription drugs that goes with the black market. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think that it's interesting that, in my view, make full disclosure, I was the lead sponsor of the legislation to reform the Rockefeller drug laws and a part of that effort for a very long time. I have always felt that the mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent offenders, the series of laws that passed over the last 30 years all across America that used mass incarceration as a way to deal with this problem, were misguided. So I come to this with firm views. And in fact, we have seen that over the last few years in New York, and in other states, we've been able to reduce the prison population while reducing sentences for drug offenders. We increased treatment, and in New York State over the last decade, crime has dropped 19%, and our prison population has declined 22%. So a lot of this is due to the fact that we're incarcerating fewer nonviolent drug offenders. So I think that the technology is there, the expertise is there. We have drug courts, some of them pioneered in Brooklyn. We have other programs that we know can work to distinguish people who are really addicts who could benefit from treatment from hardcore criminals who may take drugs, but they're not going to stop committing crimes even if they're not on drugs. The thing that has changed, interestingly, over the last few years is it's becoming more of a national bipartisan consensus, really. I note that even New Jersey's Governor Chris Christie has said that there are a lot of people out there, nonviolent drug offenders, who are spending time in prison who should really be treated for addiction. Newt Gingrich, even, not someone who I cite often for anything other than saying something ridiculous, has acknowledged very candidly that comparing Florida to New York, that New York spends less on its prisons and delivers better results. So I think we're approaching the point that we can start to have a more intelligent approach to the traditional war on drugs. But at the same time, while we've been spending a lot of resources on that, we have to shift over to a smart approach on these newly emerging problems of prescription drug diversion and synthetic drugs. We found that even the traditional drug gangs, when we bust them, they have started to carry prescription drugs also. Their market is now demanding that in addition to things like heroin and cocaine, that they carry things like Vicodin and oxycodone. So we can see which way the market is moving. We see where the problem is. We have ways to deal with it that are cheaper, safer, more humane, and more effective than mass incarceration. And I think that this is going to become more of a national trend.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. On another topic, earlier in the show we talked about prosecutions in the LIBOR scandal in the UK possibly coming to New York. That would be banks and bankers, traders who may have manipulated global interest rates to beef up their profits and charge other people or pay a lower interest rate than the market would have borne in the process. And I see that the Wall Street Journal reports that your office is investigating whether New Yorkers incurred losses from LIBOR rate manipulation. What are you looking into?
Well, I can't go into a lot of detail about an ongoing investigation, but the Connecticut Attorney General, George Jeffson, and I are working together, and we have been for some period of time. We were well before this story broke in the press recently, looking at issues of improper conduct in connection with fixing the LIBOR rates. We know that there really were two different types of problems that have been widely reported. One is during the financial crisis in 2008, apparently some banks were trying to make themselves look healthier than they were by submitting numbers that made it look as though they could borrow money more cheaply, which is the sign of health. If people don't want as high an interest rate, they think you're in good shape. And then there was an ongoing problem that goes back further in time of traders trying to add a little bit of margin by when they were making bets on currency, by getting the folks who set the LIBOR rate or reported LIBOR rate for their bank to change the number. So we're looking at all of that. I mean, and there are federal agencies involved. Also, I can't say a lot about any individual institutions or details, but I think those two areas are the prime areas that have been reported on, and I think that people are focusing on.
Would the state pension fund be the victim here, or what exactly might have lost money due to this fraud?
Well, anyone could have lost money that was, hurt by having a rate that was artificially inflated at the time their rate was adjusted, for example. So the damages on this are tricky to assess because there may be some people that benefited inappropriately from switching the LIBOR rates. So we're investigating it, and there are a lot of aspects to this. There are damages from committing fraud, but even if it's a mixed bag as far as damages are concerned, there are laws against collusion that might prohibit some of this stuff. So it's a broad investigation, and all I can say is there are a lot of agencies that are involved. I mean, keep in mind, this was not just a matter of Euro LIBOR. I mean, there's a LIBOR for the yen. There's LIBOR for everything. This is something that is a global phenomenon. So we're seeing investigations really all over the world.
Yeah, and the Wall Street Journal article that referred to you said 14 or more banks have now been ensnared. So if you get to the point of suing somebody, I guess part of the trick will be figuring out exactly who to sue.
Well, that is always one of our challenges. But this is obviously something that has to be dealt with. And I think that unfortunately, it just feeds into this ongoing sense that people have in the United States that you can't trust folks in the financial services industry. And this is something that is of great concern to me. When I was in private practice, I represented a lot of financial services firms. And I think that after the bubble and crash in mortgage-backed securities, public confidence was badly shaken. And then things like the big loss that J.P. Morgan had, on referred to as the London Whale, and the LIBOR question, it makes people feel as though there's not one set of rules for everyone. And I think it is very important. One of the themes in our Attorney General's office that we keep coming back to over and over again is the need to restore confidence that no one is above the law, that equal justice under law is more than just something carved over our courthouse doors in the United States. It is something we're really going to fight for.
We have just a few minutes left. Let me touch very briefly on a case. Well, I guess we move from everyone's favorite industry, which is the banks, to everyone's second favorite industry, which is the health insurance companies. You won a settlement with AXA Equitable over undisclosed changes to their policies that resulted in lower reimbursements for many members. What did they do, and who will they pay?
Well, this is actually a pretty straightforward case. They changed their medical claim reimbursement policy without notifying their members, and they, in spite of the policy's terms of reimbursement at the usual and customary rate, they began using different data to reimburse claims at a lower rate. So we discovered this. They've agreed to reimburse customers who lost money. We think it's going to be, you know, something in the area of $850,000 worth of reimbursements to members. And to straighten its act up going forward, there are reliable data sources for medical claims reimbursement policies, and AXA Equitable has agreed to use those data sources in the future. So it's the insurance industry is increasingly in control of our healthcare system, and it's important that we ensure that the proper regulations are in place. So this is something we're very sensitive to. As you know, we have a Medicaid Fraud Control Bureau here in the Attorney General's office, as well as a healthcare bureau, and we're working hard to make sure that in insurance, as in banking, there's one set of rules for everyone, and just because you're a big company doesn't mean you can get away with stuff when it comes to ripping off consumers who have a lot less information and wherewithal to challenge your claims.
And one final thing. There's this new controversy over Governor Cuomo trying to remove certain public records from when he was Attorney General and move them into a private file off limits to the public and to journalists. These are apparently the records pertaining to his investigation of former Governor Spitzer using the state police for political purposes. Governor Cuomo says this is about attorney-client privilege, but this is being reported as something to get ready for running for president in 2016, kind of to put some Cuomo skeletons deeper into the closet. As the current attorney general, do you have an opinion on this?
Not on what you just said. I do know that the procedures are pretty straightforward, that at the end of your term, public officials go through their documents. They're supposed to tag things or they're privileged or have confidential information, names of informants, for example. And then after that process is completed, we transfer them to the state archives. Sometimes things get transferred to the archives where that review is not done or not fully done, and what the governor is saying is that, you know, there were some documents that got through to the archives that shouldn't have been sent there. The document got out, and others will opine on this, but there is nothing unusual about going through a set of documents to check them for attorney-client privilege for confidential information to make sure that once they get to the archives, they're not released to the public inappropriately. My understanding is that these documents were never taken out of the archives, so it's removed. They were not removed. They were just flagged for a set of documents that were not to be produced, and there are procedures for challenging those denials through the Freedom of Information Law. It's not as though it's a decision that exists in a vacuum from a legal structure. But my understanding is that, there are documents that got through without having been checked before they were released to the archives, and they went back and checked them. But that's my impression of the situation. If I have learned something else, maybe I'll change my opinion. But right now, that's what it appears to be.
Former Governor, former AG Spitzer, who was, of course, the target of that investigation, said on TV last night that Cuomo doesn't have legal jurisdiction over those files anymore as no longer AG. Any legal opinion on that?
I'm not sure what he's talking about. I know that the governor worked it out with state archives to go in and have someone take a look. I'm not aware of anything that makes that illegal. It's a matter of protocol between the state archives, which do not report to the governor, by the way. They're in the state education department, which is not something in the control of the governor. I don't know that anything improper was done. Governor Spitzer is correct that they're no longer in the governor's possession. They're in the possession of the state archives. But as far as I'm aware, there was a review that should have taken place earlier that didn't, to see the confidential information wasn't released. Are there people who challenged the idea that was confidential information? There is a legal process for them to go through to challenge that assertion.
Thank you very much. Attorney General of New York State, Eric Schneiderman, thank you for talking through all these topics with us. We really appreciate your time.
Really a pleasure, Brian. I'll see you again soon.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Pentagon historian David Crist. He has written a fascinating book on the history of Iranian-U.S. relations, and he's got all kinds of revelations in here, like a secret attempt at rapprochement after 9/11 that the Bush administration turned down. He's also warning that the U.S. and Iran could kind of blunder their way accidentally into a war at any time now. So should be very interesting with David Crist coming up in a minute here on The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC.